Thanks for downloading the Wave Church podcast. We hope this message inspires and brings you into a deeper relationship with God. Enjoy the message.
Well, good morning. On behalf of Pastor Steve and Sharon, I want to welcome everyone once again to Veterans Day weekend at Wave Church. And I wonder, can we give a warm welcome to Lieutenant Jason Redman this morning? Come on, church. Very good.
Thank you.
Awesome. I know this morning, Jason, we have not only everyone who's in the room here with us today, but we actually have everyone who's joining us online, our Seaboard community and our Norfolk community joining us, and someone, a few other people who are very special to you. Your family's here with us today as well, correct?
My family is here with me. So
can we welcome his family here as well, church? Come on. Now, we're going to really unpack a lot of your story over our time together this morning, but suffice to say at this point, we'd love everyone to just be aware that Jason actually joined the Navy, of all days, on September 11th of 1992. Had no clue what was coming in 2001 at that point, what that day would later mean for other people, and yet it was the start of an incredible journey for you. That we're going to get into today together. But I'd be interested to ask, just at the start with our time we have, what kind of upbringing leads to an American hero like yourself? What's your origin story? What's your family background? Was it a surprise to anyone that you enlisted? Tell us a little bit about your family.
No. First off, thank you to all of you and definitely our veterans and military family members, a couple of teammates in here, so big shout out and respect. I came from a Christian-based, very patriotic family, and the military had run in our heritage. My grandfather on both sides fought in World War II. Grandfather on my dad's side, very decorated B-24 pilot. My great uncle on my dad's side again was shot down and killed in the Pacific in World War II. So just grew up with this love of the military. My dad was Army jump master, and I remember when I was a kid, I used to wear his old Army clothes. He had an old, they call it DRMO, meaning they put it out of service. He had an old parachute I used to play with when I was a kid and imagine I was jumping out of airplanes and stuff. And we just raised in that mindset. And if the doors were open in the church, we were in the church. So I was raised in a strong family and just had that focus from a young age. My dad told me about the SEAL teams when I was about 14 because back then, all SEALs, up until the late 90s, early 2000s, went through U.S. Army jump school. So my dad had actually met SEALs back when he had gone through, and he told me about him and said, hey, you may want to check this out. This may be up your alley. And he was right. I looked into it, and I said, hey, this is what I want to do.
So you were about 14 when you had that conversation, going through high school, checking things out. Now, when you did enlist, did you go straight into the Naval Special Warfare Pipeline? Were you doing anything else in the Navy prior and then, you know, kind of a pivot at some point in your career from the ground up? Were you straight to BUDS when you enlisted?
I was focused on going straight to BUDS. The pipeline is different now than what it was back then. It wasn't quite as direct. I actually enlisted to become an intelligence specialist. I started my career right here at Dam Neck. The Navy Marine Corps Intelligence School is here at Dam Neck. So started my career there with the desire and dreams to go to SEAL training. Training was a little delayed, so I actually got assigned to the headquarters East Coast SEAL team where I worked as an intelligence specialist there before I headed off to SEAL training. So it wasn't direct, but it was pretty direct compared to the way they do the pipeline now.
Okay, so you eventually had the invitation to the dance, so to speak. You get there, you check in. What class were you a part of?
I was supposed to start with class 197, and like many young Navy knuckleheads, was riding my motorcycle and wrecked right in front of Lynn Haven Mall. So I broke my shoulder, which stopped me from classing up with 197.
Broke your shoulder?
So classed up with 200, three classes later, went through with 200 Hell Week, got rolled, and graduated with class 202.
Okay, so for those who don't know, when you say you got rolled, what does that mean? Does that mean like stop, drop, and roll like a fire drill? Or?
No, it means, believe it or not, only about 25% of SEAL students make it through with the same class. Training's pretty arduous. Sometimes you may have a performance role, meaning you didn't perform at the level you needed to, but they felt like you were a good student, so they would roll you back to the next class to give you an opportunity to fix yourself. Or there'd be an injury, and I got injured, so I got rolled back to the next class. I actually double rolled two classes. So,
wow! But you made it through.
I made it through.
That's what matters.
Yeah.
And so you got your orders. Where'd you head after that?
I came back to Virginia Beach and was assigned to Little Creek SEAL Team, SEAL Team 4, and pre 9/11. So an interesting time. Obviously, those that were pre 9/11 versus post 9/11. A lot more training, and we were doing things back then. I was doing things Central and South America, which led up to becoming a training instructor and then getting selected for a commission and starting school at Old Dominion University in the summer of 2001.
Okay, so any ODU grads in the house here? Come on now. Show some pride. There we go. Go Monarchs.
Go Monarchs.
Right. Sorry, okay, there, later. Karma. My bad, my bad. It was something Pastor Robert did. Karma keeps looking at Pastor Robert like breakfast is served right over here. I don't know if you can see that in Norfolk or Seaboard right now, but I love it. This is a Wave Church first right here, getting to have Karma on stage with us, so that's exciting. But so 2001 hits, 9/11 happens. You were in school at the time?
I was, and there were several other SEALs with me, friends of mine that got selected for this commissioning program, and like many of you, it is a day that if you remember, which amazingly, I guess if you're above 25 is kind of the breaking point that you probably remember where you were, and I was actually leaving class. Went to the student center to grab a cup of coffee and meet with another good friend of mine. And I remember getting my cup of coffee, and the barista guy was like very nervously like, the world's coming to an end, man. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he goes, the Pentagon's on fire and a plane crashed into the World Trade Center. And I was like, okay, that's weird. So took my coffee and walked over and started watching the TV like everybody else. And we watched it all unfold. And looked at my buddy like many of us realized in that moment. I mean, the second plane hit, I was like, we're at war. And I'm going to take a moment to embarrass the hell out of a very good friend of mine. And because he is a New York firefighter who actually was in the towers when they fell and survived. And he is a brother of mine, and I love him. So I'm glad you are here, brother.
Come on. That's awesome. So you watch all that transpire on the screen. You're a warrior. How much time did you have left in the education at that point, in the degree program you were in?
I had just started. So, I mean, it was pretty hard to watch. And like several of us, I actually went back. I came back to my Little Creek SEAL team only a couple of days after 9/11 happened. And so I said, hey, I want out of this program. I know things are going to start happening. And I had an amazing leader. I write a lot about him in both books. And very prophetically, when I went back, he said, this is not a war that's going to be over quickly. He said, this is a war that will go on for decades. He said, go back to school. He said, we're going to need guys in the future. So he said, finish your degree. He said, don't worry, your time will come. And prophetically, he was very right.
Wow. And so you went into school, come out the other side, you're now an officer. Did that change your experience at all on the teams, going from being enlisted to officer? Did you feel like overnight people treated you differently? I mean, how was that for you?
It was a rough journey. I actually made some mistakes as a young leader, and that's really what my book, The Trident, is all about. I think some guys have a really easy transition. My transition was a little rougher, and I think a lot of that had to do with that transition also from a peacetime military to a wartime military. There was a lot of changes in our tactics and how we did things because we recognized very quickly this was a very different war. and it caused us to have to adapt and change. So I won't get into all those details. The bottom line is I had a few hiccups along the way that I had to fix myself, and thankfully I had some good leaders who said, hey, we're going to give you the opportunity to fix yourself.
And it's not that you don't talk about them. They're covered extensively in your book. So if anyone is interested, they can check out your books. Where can they find those? I mean, I know one of them you have here with us today.
Yeah, we have the Trident out there also. So if you're interested afterwards, we're going to sign some books. But that is really the story of the Trident. It's a story of a leadership failure, but coming back and coming to understand what it is to effectively lead and a lot of the mistakes that I made and started to grow up and realize. So then redemption and the wounding and all that. So it was a pretty long, hard journey. But finally figuring it out and getting my career back on track, which led me into getting ready to go to Iraq in the spring of 2007.
Okay, so then you did deploy with the team. Are you still with Team 4 at this point, or where... Where are you based out of? Where are you?
I was still at Little Creek. I was assigned to Team 10 at that time. Okay. And we were a assault troop that was assigned to the Al-Anbar province of Iraq. So we were operating in the entire western region, which really was the heart of the Al-Qaeda organization based out of Fallujah, and doing a lot of work, obviously, throughout the Anbar province and trying to influence a lot of Iraq. And 2006 and 2007 was a very volatile time in Iraq. The Anbar Awakening was occurring, the surge was occurring, so it was pretty intense combat for a lot of people. A lot of my friends and individuals I know were wounded or killed in those years, and for us, getting there in that time frame, the 06-07 time frame, really intense. We were almost getting into firefights every night, we were almost doing missions every night, and...
So a pretty heavy op tempo for you. What was the mission set? What were you guys specifically entrusted to do in Anbar at that time?
So our primary mission was direct action. So we were targeting mid-level to high-level Al-Qaeda and insurgent leaders. So it was capture-kill operations designed to go after, utilize intel to try and find these guys and capture them if possible, or obviously send them on their way if not.
And they knew we were looking for them at that point in time. I mean, it was very heavy fighting. So they've taken a number of precautions, preparations to not just roll the red carpet out for you guys to come in. What were some of the concerns you guys, you know, we do have a number of civilians in the room here. What are some of the concerns on those sorts of missions that you guys really had to be prepared for? And it wasn't a matter of if, but when.
Well, it was a really tough war, I think, for many of the people that obviously have been involved in it, because unlike several of the wars of the past, I mean, the enemy did not wear a uniform. They were very good at just blending in with the population. They were very good at engaging us, and then knowing our rules of engagement, they would put their gun away, and then they would move to another point where they would have another gun staged. So in that process, you know, because they blended in with the civilian population, you know, you had to be very careful. And I know that for a lot of our troops out there, it was very hard to try and operate within the rules of engagement when the enemy often would use it against you because they understood. They also were ruthless and very brutal. Frequently, we would go in on targets where they would utilize their own people as human shields. They would put them in front and then shoot through them to try and get to us. We entered a target in June where we had 11 to 15 women and children sleeping in a courtyard, and we were going by them to go into the house, and they started throwing grenades down on us right next to the women and children. So, I mean, like in their mind, the ends justified the means to them. You know, they just felt like it was the will of their God, you know, whatever happened. So pretty brutal. Frequently, they would wear suicide vests. I mean, obviously, they believed they were justified in that also, and that was often a tactic they would utilize if we were going in on a target. They would have a security detail for the leader, and they would wear suicide vests, and if you got too close, it was their modus operandi to clack themselves off, to try and, they'd kill themselves to try and take you out, to prevent you from getting to the leader.
Right. And so you we're really coming up on the tail end of a deployment. I mean, you've been, how, I mean, by September, how long had you been in country at that point in time?
Since May. So we'd been there almost a full 6 months at this point, pretty intense, heavy fighting. We had lost a SEAL, Petty Officer Clark Swedler, at the very beginning of the deployment. We had lost SEAL, Petty Officer Jason Lewis, and a couple of our support guys in the middle of the deployment, and then we had had several guys wounded through that path.
So, the end is in sight.
1 week.
We have one week left. I mean, I'm
sending the first wave home.
Okay, so first wave, you already have some of the team headed home. Obviously, you know, the Connex boxes, they're packed up. Things are heading out. But you go ahead and you get word, September 13th, there's going to be an op. You're going to be leading the crew out there. And what happens?
Yeah, we walked into a really well-executed ambush. We were going after the number one leader for the Anbar province for al-Qaeda, and just, long story short, walked into a really intense ambush. we had broken off from the main element. We had seen some individuals that were moving in another house. That's unusual at that time of night, especially after guys in blacked-out helicopters come in and take down a target. So we moved on these guys to see who they were and what they knew, and literally we walked into their ambush. So myself and there were six of us that were in this maneuver element. So three of the six were initially hit in the volley of gunfire, PKM machine gun. My medic was hit. One of our other guys ran forward to grab the medic to pull him back, and he was shot three times. I was shot, stitched across the body armor. I took two rounds in the left elbow, and then rounds off my gun helmet, and took a round in the face. And very intense firefight. When I woke up, the firefight lasted about 40 minutes. And when I woke up, I remember laying on my back and coming to and literally watching tracer fire travel about 8 inches above me, and just thinking to myself, man, this is a really bad position to be in. But I also thought about the fact that, you know, hey, I've just got to trust my teammates. There's nothing I can do. I can't sit up. I'm too mangled. So you're just going to have to wait. You're just going to have to be patient. And I tried to get my tourniquet on, and unfortunately, I couldn't get... I thought my arm had been shot off at this point. It actually was pinned under my body. But I had no feeling in that arm, so I was like, man, you got to get a tourniquet on or else you're going to bleed out. So I couldn't get the tourniquet on and losing a lot of blood and started to reach this point in this gunfight where I was like, you know, you're not going to make it. And that's a tough thought to come up against when you realize that you're about to die. And obviously I thought of my family. And I thought of the memories that were not going to be created when I died. And then I thought, I got angry. I will tell you that. I got angry about the fact that we had allowed ourselves, or I had allowed us, I guess, as a leader to get into this position. Mm. And it was at that moment that I just said, man, I got to go home. Like, I don't want to give the enemy the satisfaction of killing me. I need to get home to my family. And I called out to God, and I said, Lord, I need the strength to go home. And I'll tell you, if you have ever been grievously injured, where there's a massive loss of blood and you're starting to go into shock, in this case, hypovolemic shock, your body goes through this physiological process that if you at least have trained somewhat in trauma, you know the signs. And I knew the signs. Like, I knew, I was getting cold in my extremities. I was starting not to be able to feel my extremities. It got to the point where I tried to move my right hand, and I couldn't even move that, and there was nothing wrong with my right arm. It was just from my body was shutting down. And it got to where every breath was a massive effort, as if like this 10,000-pound weight had been put on my chest. And when I called out to God, all of a sudden, like this, I had energy.
Wow.
I had energy. And I don't know, to this day, I can't tell you at what point in that 40-minute, 45-minute gunfight did that occur. But I do know this. I was able to I focused on stay awake to stay alive. That was this thought that popped in my head after I made that prayer, and I had the energy. We ended up calling in a fire mission, multiple fire missions, which to this day was the closest closest fire mission ever brought in the entire Iraq war. And for those that may not understand that term, when we talk about a fire mission, it means there's an aircraft overhead that is putting munitions on a target. And typically when friendly forces are calling in munitions, we understand that there is a certain space of separation we have to maintain, because when you drop bullets and bombs and things like this, we know there's a level of fragmentation and explosive force that goes out. So when you're inside that, it becomes danger close. And we were extreme danger close. The machine gun that had me pinned down was about where the cameras were a little bit, you know, so it was about 45 feet. So the gunship originally denied and said, there's no way, we will kill you guys. But thankfully, my team leader, and I owe my life to my teammates, I owe my life to this gunship, I owe my life to God. And they coordinated and did a very good job of bringing those rounds in as I lay there and patiently had to wait.
Were you undercover? I mean, they're that close. You're trying to render aid to yourself, put on a tourniquet. I mean, I imagine they could have seen you were moving. I mean, were you behind something at that
point?
No,
I was laying. It was nothing but,
so
you know,
you're
it was,
in, you're
it was
wide
pretty
open
much
land,
as flat as this
45
stage.
Minutes.
Yeah.
Tracers flying over your head.
I actually took rounds while I was laying on the ground. I have my helmet. There is a hole in my helmet. For whatever reason, I took my helmet off in the middle of this fight. Go figure. Here, let me take off this life-saving piece of equipment and set it next to me. But I did it. And I actually took a round through my helmet laying next to me. I also took a round off my right side plate. And this is another God moment. I typically did not wear my side plates when we were doing assaults, and the reason being, I wanted to be lighter. In special operations, you have a little bit of latitude in your gear selection. There are certain things you have to have. There are other things you're allowed to choose. And for me, because we typically patrolled long ways, we were climbing over walls, things like that, on a lot of missions, I would not wear them. And on this night, it was an assault, and normally I would wear them, and I literally was not going to wear them, and this little voice before I went on that mission was like, wear your side plates. I was like, I don't normally wear my side plates, and it was like, wear your side plates. I was like, it was a high-risk mission. We knew that the enemy that we were going up against was at a very high level. We knew he had a very robust security detail. So I put my side plates in, and I took a round directly off my right side plate while I was laying on the ground. I remember it hitting me. And if I had not had that side plate in, you know, it probably, I don't know. I mean, it would have blown out my spine, kidneys, I don't know. So all of that to be said, to come full circle to that moment when I said, God, I need the strength to get up. I had that strength. And when the helicopter medevac finally came in, the Army Special Operations Aviation Squadron medevac helicopter, it had to land about 75 yards from where we were. And my buddy started to drag me, and it really hurt. And I was like, stop it. I was like, let me get up. And I said, grab my arm and grab my helmet, because I still thought my arm had been shot off, and walked those 75 yards and got on the helicopter under my own power. And that's God, because to this day, I can't explain it. Doctors were amazed by the amount of blood. I lost almost half the blood in my body. I had seven blood transfusions over the next 48 hours between Baghdad, Balad, and Landstuhl, and I think even a couple more when I got home to Bethesda. And they were like, we don't know how you survived. And the only thing I'll say about all of that is it's literally a walking miracle, because I went from not being able to move a muscle to being able to get up and get on that helicopter. Wow. And I'd love to tell all of you that, oh, well, my faith is so unshakable that, you know, because I lived this miracle. And it's not. I struggle sometimes, too. And that really bothers me sometimes. I'm like, wow, Lord, I asked my whole life for you to prove to me that you exist, which is a dangerous thing to do, so be very wary of this. I was like, just show me. And he's like, pow, I showed you. And then now I still sometimes struggle in my faith. But so it took me a long time to both read the Bible and come to understand that, and I came to this epiphany about Thomas. Thomas being one of Jesus' disciples who walked with him. And I was like, and if you know his name, he's called Doubting Thomas. And I'm like, okay, wait a minute. So if Thomas walked with Jesus, and I mean, imagine this, you're walking with the man himself, and he's like throwing out miracles like candy to kids on Halloween, like, here's a miracle for you, and here's a miracle for you, and Joe, you want a miracle?
I got I'll one. Take
wait,
one.
Oh, wait a minute. I just dropped this. It's a miracle. And if Thomas walked with him, and then after Jesus was crucified and passed away, and the other disciples were like, Jesus is still alive. And instead of Thomas being like, wow, I watched all these miracles, I can buy this. He was like, nope, I don't buy it. And then he actually sees him, and he's like, show me. Show me your hand. Show me your side. So it makes me feel like, you know, I'm okay. Like, I'm not messed up. Like, I sometimes feel like, man, you're a terrible Christian. God gave you this great miracle, and you doubt sometimes. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, faith is that. It is believing despite sometimes these hard, concrete things, and we all struggle and see these things. So my advice is don't beat yourself up if sometimes you ever struggle with faith, because I know I'm a walking miracle, and sometimes I do.
Yeah. How good is that? Now, you didn't land that just in the span of, you know, 48, 72 hours. I think it was about 96 hours. You get stateside. You're in Bethesda by then. And there was a road to recovery. And really, at first, people didn't know how to engage with you. And you set the rules of engagement in that moment with an incredible sign, that's given so much hope and courage to so many. Would you share with us a little bit about that sign for those who don't know and really how you think it could apply to them as they're facing whatever they may be facing in life now themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. So the sign on the door really has become recognized. You know, definitely millions and millions of people have seen it. Secretary Robert Gates wrote about it in his book. First Lady Michelle Obama wrote about it not once, but twice in her book. It moved her so much. And what it came from is there were some people in my room there expressing a pretty high level of pity for my injuries. And I was dozing, and they were having a conversation, but I overheard the conversation. It was just, you know, hey, we send these young men and women off to war, and they're broken. They're never going to be the same. You know, they're never going to be able to achieve their full potential because we've, you know, mentally, physically, and emotionally broken them from this war. And they left, and I remember thinking to myself, is that true? Is that really me? Is that who I am? And I will admit, I was struggling. This, you know, here I was, this guy who had made some leadership mistakes, and over a two-year period had to fight, claw, and earn back the respect and credibility of my teammates to be able to lead them, and had done that. And now suddenly had this great successful deployment, and now found myself in a hospital bed with doctors saying, hey, we're going to probably have to amputate your arm. You're looking at years of surgeries. You know, your special operations career is over. So I was struggling. So when I heard this, for a couple of minutes, you know, I was by myself in the room, and then the long-haired admiral came back in, and I motioned to her and said, hey, hand me my pen, because I couldn't talk. I was trached. I was wired shut. They were feeding me from a stomach tube. I couldn't get out of the bed. You know, I had all this hardware in my arm. And I wrote to her, never again. Never again is somebody going to come into this room feeling sorry for who I am. And this is where it comes down to. All of us in life are going to have catastrophic, I call them life ambushes. These are these really hard, negative moments that I define them as they will forever leave scars on you. They will be mental scars, emotional scars, physical scars, or financial scars, or a combination of multiple. And when they come, it's so easy to think to ourselves, like, this is the end. Like, my life is over. I laid out this path, but this happened, and I'm never going to recover from it. And in the moment, it's easy to buy into that. And I remember laying in that bed kind of feeling the same way. But the great news is you have a choice. God gave you a choice. It's one of the greatest things in our faith, free will. He doesn't tell you how you have to live your life, but you have a choice in how to live it. And your ability to choose positivity over negativity has amazing ripple effects on everybody around you. And it was in that moment, laying in that hospital bed, that I thought of my family, you know, my kids who two are here. And I thought about, man, I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be the Lieutenant Dan from Forrest Gump that, you know, my kids are like ashamed of me because I couldn't, you know, get it together. And there were other wounded warriors around me who were severely injured. And I had been through this incredible leadership journey where I was like, hey, man, you got to lead always. And I was like laying there thinking, yeah, bro, that includes in this hospital bed. So let's go. So it was in that moment that I wrote out this sign, and it said, attention to all who enter here. If you're coming in this room with sadness or sorrow, don't bother. The wounds that I received, I got in a job that I love, doing it for people that I love, defending the freedom of a country I deeply love. I'll make a full recovery. What is full, that is the absolute utmost physically, I have the ability to recover. And then I will push that about 20% further through sheer mental tenacity. This room you're about to enter is a room of fun, optimism, and intense rapid regrowth. If you are not prepared for that, go elsewhere. And yeah, I know.
Robert, what'd you do?
So, you know, so all I can say is that life is hard. I don't care if you're a Christian or you're not a Christian. Life's hard. To be human is hard. To be human is to struggle. There's always going to be ambushes that come along. For us, I believe there's a stronger component because you have something to fall back to. There's life after death, and we're all going to die. You know, it's a one guaranteed thing. But to choose positivity, to lift up others around you, I mean, it's like such a powerful thing, especially when they expect you to be a victim. They expect you to feel sorry for yourself because you've had some horrific thing happen. If you can choose positivity in that moment, man, the impacts of it just go out like throwing a big rock into a still lake. I mean, the ripples just go out and hit the shore all around.
So what I'm hearing you say is, for anyone here who maybe they are in that moment, because it would be normal to look at that and just sit in, I can never go back to what I was. And yet you found a new mission set. Yes. You gave yourself a new ridgeline to go towards. If anyone feels like they're in the midst of that moment, would you say the most important thing is mindset? Mindset over how much money you have, connections you have, whatever you think you do or don't have. You would say that deciding piece would be really your mindset building on the foundation of faith.
Absolutely. And I think that happiness comes from knowing who you are and living what you aspire to be. It doesn't mean you're perfect. Man, I fall short all the time. But it means that I want to live my life in a way because I understand who I am. In the military, I'm launching a new program in 2021 called Point Man for Life. And it's been an interesting, because I've written about all these different things. In Overcome, there's a lot of leadership lessons. The Trident is more of a story, but there's leadership lessons in that. And I'm a student of leadership. I'm a student of how, as human beings, we can be the best versions of ourselves. And it made me realize that why do so many of our veterans struggle when we get into the civilian world? Well, it's because in the military, man, here's your mission. And you have the mission both of being a United States military member and the patriotism and everything this flag represents and that the incredible history that goes behind it. And then you have the mission of your service you're assigned to. And then you have the mission of your unit. And then you have the mission of the job and how you fit into that. So, like, it's like laser focus. And then if you're deployed, you have specific missions that you're going after. Well, all these things guide you on where you need to go. And then within that, you have, you know, if it gets to what you're doing, then you have a destination, and we have a course, and the course are those short-term waypoints, and then we do analysis and intelligence to understand the risks and the indicators of the ambushes are coming, and then, oh, by the way, we train so that if everything goes wrong, how to get off the X out of these ambushes that come along. Mm. Well, you get into the civilian world, and there is no roadmap for that. You have to create it yourself, and that's what I realized, all these things align, And if you can define the mission for your own life, who you are, what is your mission for you and you and you? And you can look at that and you can say, this is the destination that I want to achieve in my life, the long-term goals. This is my course, so that if you get off course, you can get back on course. And then the last thing, you know, your mission, your life's mission objective, what is the legacy that you hope to leave behind? Because someday we're all going to die. And so you have, thankfully, as a Christian, you have the life after that, but you want to know that in this life, you made a difference, that the life you led set an example, and that mission correlates with being a great parent. It correlates with being a great employee or boss. It correlates with being a good family member, a good church member, a good community member, a good leader, and that mission keeps you on course to do all those things. Mm.
So, I mean, statistically, there's a number of people who have answered the call to serve our nation, and many of them are, they're home from the battlefront, but they're in a fight for their life. I know at our Norfolk location, our Seaboard location, even online right now, there's people around the world who are watching, and maybe they're in that fight right now themselves. They've answered the call, they've served, and in serving, they've seen the greatest humanity has to offer, and they've also seen the worst. What would be an encouragement you would give them?
You've got to find your new mission, and that's the biggest thing. And I will say this. I used to believe that a new mission and a new purpose was the answer for our veterans, and it is, but you can't land a broken airplane on a great runway. It doesn't matter. You have to fix the airplane first. And there's a lot of our veterans out there that are struggling. I struggled with PTSD. I got diagnosed with a minor TBI, and there were a lot of things that I had to do over the years to address that, karma being one of those things. So if you out there are a veteran and you're struggling, it's okay. I think there's some of us that feel like, oh, I've got to be stronger than this, and I've got to set the example. I'm a warrior. You know, war doesn't bother me. Well, yeah, it does. It bothers all of us. I mean, I hate to tell you, it is not normal to see the insides of people on their outsides. And if you've seen that in any kind of horrific situation, after a while, it starts to erode at you. So don't be afraid to ask for help. There are a lot of great organizations. You don't have to fix it yourself. And I think that's what I thought. And there's no shame in saying, hey, man, I'm struggling. There's a lot of us that have struggled. I struggled. And once you can get past that hurdle and heal yourself, then you can define your new mission, and you can set that destination, get on that course, and, man, get off that X and find some success in this life.
I love that. Come on. Any parting words, anything else you'd like to say? We've certainly enjoyed our time together with you today. Anything else you'd like to say to anyone here or anyone watching online or any of our other campuses?
No, I just want to say thank you. I mean, we are a very strong military town. You know, these are interesting times right now, what's going on in the world. But at the end of the day, regardless of what's happening on the political spectrum or around you, I mean, you control your own destiny. You have a choice. So, you know, be positive and set the example for others around you. I hate this division we're seeing where people feel like, oh, I have to be so far over here, I have to be so far over here. Jesus was incredibly direct, but he reached out to everyone. It didn't matter whether it was a prostitute, Gentile, Jew, it didn't matter. Like, Jesus was about trying to bring people together, and I think we need more of that.
Absolutely. One more time, church, can we say thank you? Thank you, sir, so much. Thank you
thank
for
you
your
guys.
Service. Thank you for speaking to us today. Come on, let's really show honor this morning. Every one of our locations, even at Norfolk and Seaboard online. And as well, I'd love to wonder if we could just again say thank you to who he affectionately refers to as the long-haired admiral and their children here as well. Thank you, honestly, for continuing to share your family with our nation. And always giving us a great reminder that these freedoms we have, they're honestly not free. And we thank you for that. We thank you for sharing Jason, his husband, his father, with us. It means a lot. So one more time, church, please be seated. Yes, you can give a hand as well. And there's one more thing we'd like to do this morning. Again, if you're with us online right now, I want to encourage you to stay focused in this moment. If you're with us in Norfolk or Seaboard, we're not done quite yet. And that is this. You know, as Jason was sharing through our conversation today, he reiterated time and again how faith is woven all throughout his journey. It was one of the initial seeds that was sown into his life all those years ago, growing up in his household. And then even then, you know, he's talking about how he's in a firefight, critically wounded, laying on his back, tracer rounds going around, other rounds continuing to hit his plates, his helmet. And even in a moment like that, God found him. Even in a moment like that, where his teammates, his brothers, were out of reach, God was not out of reach. Maybe you're in a moment right now, and you feel like in the battle with life, you feel like you're bleeding out emotionally, bleeding out spiritually, and you feel alone. It is our hope, it is our prayer that you could discover what Jason discovered all those years ago, is that no matter where you go, you cannot outrun the love in the presence of Jesus. And if you're in this place today, and you feel like you've got some scars, you have some wounds, maybe there's a fight you're fighting in your life and you're not letting anyone know about it, and you think, I can't tell anyone about this because if I tell them about this fight, they won't look at me the same, they won't like me, they won't respect me. All those lies that we tell ourselves when we crawl into our emotions and our own heads. I want to encourage you this morning. I want to encourage you this morning that Jesus loves you right where you're at. He loves you just the way that you are. I love how in Jason's story, when he was in the middle of being wounded, his brothers didn't turn their backs on him. They just upped the fight. They called in fire, danger close. They had the air support, everything that they needed. It was dispatched to bring that man home. And can I tell you something? Heaven had a danger close scenario thousands of years ago when Jesus Christ was sent into the fight for you. He gave his own life so you could live. He gave his own life so your story doesn't have to end where it's at right now. And so if you're in this place this morning and you know what it's like to seek but never find, if you know what it's like to know the standard and that you don't measure up, if you know what it's like to have something that you aspired to do and the people that you love the most, you had the opportunity to live up to the standard, and you missed it completely. And you feel broken. You feel hurt. You feel lost. Can I tell you something? Jesus isn't done with your life yet. But our God is a gentleman, and he only goes where he's invited. And I want to give you an opportunity today to stop trying to put the pieces of life together again on your own, and to instead see what happens when you put your life in the hands of Jesus. And so if you're watching online, there's a button right there on the screen. If you're in that life battle that I'm talking about right now, and you're saying, Joe, I've tried everything I know how to do, and I'm still coming up short. Friend, I want to tell you something today. There is hope in the name of Jesus, and we would love to pray with you. We would love to pray for you already. I know multiple people have clicked that button on the screen saying, yes, I want to make a decision to follow Jesus. If you're in that fight we're talking about right now, click that button on the screen. And if you're here at Great Neck, at our Seaboard or our Norfolk locations, and you're watching right now and you're saying, Joe, I know what it feels like to feel lost. I know what it feels like to feel broken. Joe, I'm in the middle of it and I don't know if there's another side to this valley I'm in. This feels like game over. Friend, I want to tell you today that there is hope in the name of Jesus. And you don't have to put yourself together. You don't have to fix yourself up. He will come to you right where you are at. And I want to pray for you today that you could know his hope, that you could know his love, that you could know his life, that you could know his purpose, that you could know that sense of meaning and significance again. And maybe all the world has turned its back on you. Heaven has not turned its back on you. And so I'm not going to ask you to stand up. I'm not going to ask you to embarrass yourself in any way, shape, or form. But I do want to pray with you, and I want to pray for you today. And so we're going to give you privacy in this moment across all of our locations. If we could bow our heads, close our eyes, I want to pray for you right here, right now. And in the same way that for Jason, a warrior, a man who knew what it was like to fight, there came a moment where he needed the power of team. This is your moment where you need to rest in the strength of another. And that someone else is Jesus Christ. So if you're in this place today and over these past couple minutes, you know that I'm speaking to you. I'm speaking to your situation. And you're saying, Joe, if God's not done with me, if Jesus is a God of love and he's a God of grace and he's not going to judge me and he's not disappointed in me, you're telling me God has more for me. Joe, if that's what God's all about, if that is who Jesus is, I want to know him today. If that's your heart, I want to pray for you. And what I'm going to ask is if on three, you can lift your hand high enough and long enough for me to see it. In the last service, there was a number of people who were saying, yeah, Joe, that's me. I want to know Jesus. I'm not done fighting this fight, and I need his strength. I want to know who he says I am. If that's you in this place this morning, then one, two, three. Go ahead across all our locations. Begin to lift your hand. There's a hand there, 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 a hand right here, a hand right here. Others here this morning. Others here this morning. Yes, sir, I see another hand right over there. Anyone else in here today saying, man, Joe, that's me. I hear what you're saying, and I believe today God's not done with me, and I receive his love, and I'm asking him into my life story. Yep, I see another hand right over there. Anyone else in here, you haven't lifted your hand yet, or maybe I didn't see it. Please lift it high enough, long enough for me to be able to see it this morning. Others here. I believe there's other people here at Seaboard, at Norfolk, online right now, continuing to click those buttons. Yes, sir, I see another hand right up there in the upper level. Anyone else in here this morning saying, Joe, that's me. Pray for me. I want to know Jesus. I'm done fighting this fight on my own. Last call right now. Awesome. Well, Wave Church, can we give a hand for every single person online and across all of our campuses who said yes to Jesus this morning? Come on. We're going to pray a prayer together right now. And it's not about the words. Here's what it's about. It's about the heart behind the words. So I'm going to ask that we all pray together. And maybe you're saying, Joe, I didn't lift my hand. Why do I need to pray? It's a sign of support with those who did. Because you know what? Every single person who just lifted your hand, you may not realize it, but you are opting in to become a part of a family that has spanned thousands of years, every continent of this earth, and it is the kingdom of God, where all are welcome, everyone belongs, and there's a plan and a purpose for each one of us. So every person who lifted their hand, we're going to pray together and welcome you into not just any family, but God's family. So let's all pray together right now across all our locations. Everyone say, Dear Jesus, I need you. Come into my life. Thank you for never giving up on me. I give you my past, my present, and my future. I give you my sin, and I receive your promises. I now confess I am a child of God. My eternity is secure, and I now follow you, Jesus. Amen. And amen. Come on, church, let's give a hand for every single person who said yes to Jesus this morning.
Thanks for listening to the Wave Church Podcast. If you made a decision today to follow Jesus, please go to wavechurch.com and click on I Made a Decision so we can help you on your way to know God in a deeper way. And if you want to visit one of our locations, the website can help you locate the campus near you, or you can live stream our services. Have a great day.